This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. During the years my guest James Baker served as Secretary of State, 1989 to 92, the Berlin Wall fell, the Soviet Union collapsed, we fought the Gulf War, and the Israelis and Palestinians began face-to-face talks. Baker has written a memoir about his tenure as Secretary of State called The Politics of Diplomacy. Baker was appointed by President Bush. The two men were old friends. Baker first entered politics to help Bush in his losing Senate campaign in 1970. Baker went on to work in Ronald Reagan's 1980 presidential campaign and then served as Reagan's White House Chief of Staff and Treasury Secretary. He ran George Bush's 1988 presidential campaign and left his position as Secretary of State to take over Bush's re-election campaign in 92. One of Baker's greatest accomplishments was in helping to begin talks between Israelis, Palestinians, and Arabs. But in his memoir, Baker says he wanted to avoid the Middle East peace process. He saw it as a pitfall to be avoided rather than an opportunity to be exploited. I asked him what initially discouraged him about getting involved.
Well, I had watched other secretaries of state become involved, and in almost every instance, they got burned and got burned badly. Before I entered into the job, I went around and sat down with every living ex-president of the United States and almost every living ex-secretary of state to get their advice on the job. And many of them said, avoid the Middle East if you can, that most secretaries of state get sucked into that. You really can't do much unless the parties themselves are willing to take the necessary steps to make peace. And so I entered my tour of duty as Secretary of State with that in mind.
You felt betrayed by Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir. Why?
Well, I felt betrayed because we worked very, very hard to construct a Palestinian delegation Prime Minister Shamir's rules and his formula. And the government of Israel, he refused to go along with one Palestinian representative who was a dual addressee, that is, someone who lived in the West Bank but had an apartment in Jerusalem. He refused to go along with that person on the Palestinian delegation because he had an apartment in Jerusalem didn't vote for moving forward, and the government fell. And I thought that was an extraordinarily technical issue on which to really subvert a lot of efforts that we'd made toward getting a peace process started.
Why did you see the end of the Gulf War as an opportunity for Middle East peace talks?
Well, because the Cold War clearly was over. The Arab rejectionist states no longer had a patron in the Soviet Union that would be willing to keep them armed and send them armaments. We Americans had defeated Arab rejectionism in the Gulf by defeating Iraq. We had great credibility with the Arab states, with Saudi Arabia and with Egypt and with Jordan and other states. And we felt we could get them to change their longstanding policy of refusing to speak to Israel and get them to come to the table with Israel. And indeed, we were able to do that.
So how did you proceed differently after the war than you had before the war?
After the war, we put in process a double track. Before the war, we were trying to set up a dialogue between Israelis and Palestinians from within the territories. After the war, worked on a dialogue between Israel, Palestinians from within the territories, and Israel's Arab neighbor states. We also had not only bilateral negotiations like that, we also had multilateral negotiations to discuss issues such as economic issues and cultural issues and so forth, and in multilateral discussions, which involved a lot more countries in the region, not just Israel's neighbors, involved countries like Saudi Arabia and so forth.
When you were trying to get Israelis and Palestinians to agree to sit down at the table and talk, what were the most compelling arguments you made to each side?
Well, you don't have a lot of leverage. As I point out in the book, the main leverage you have is that they all want America to be involved and to be engaged. That's one of the reasons some of these prior former secretaries of state and former presidents said, don't touch it, because they'll suck you in and then they won't make the necessary moves required to make progress. And we would frequently say, well, if you're not willing to do this, then we'd have to say that the talks broke down because you were unwilling to do this. And that would generally keep things moving.
Is there an element of therapy, or at least like psyching everybody out when you're doing this kind of diplomacy?
Well, I don't know that it's psyching everybody out. I mean, I think they all know that they want to avoid the political opprobrium of being blamed for the collapse of a peace effort. Nobody wants to have that that tag put on them. And they do want to keep us engaged, both the Israelis and the Arabs. And so I used those two pieces of bits of leverage as best I could.
Let's talk about the Gulf War. The Iran-Iraq War ended toward the end of the Reagan administration. And then President Bush ordered a strategic review on Iraq shortly after he was elected. And, you know, one of the big questions about our so-called tilt toward Iraq in the early days of the Bush administration was that, you know, you apparently were warned by the CIA that Iraq was advancing its nuclear missile programs and developing chemical and biological weapons. So how much did you take that into account when strengthening our relations with Iraq?
The thinking was that at the end of the Iran-Iraq war, Iraq was pretty much a worn-out country, that they had to rebuild, that they had to consolidate. They'd fought a long and exhausting war. It made good sense for us, in my view, to try and see if we could establish reasonably good relations with them and moderate their behavior. We were unable to do that with a policy of engagement. I say in the book that I think it's too bad we didn't have Iraq higher up on our radar screen than we did. The top policymakers, President Bush, myself, and perhaps others, were really not paying much attention to Iraq because we were involved with the collapse of communism, with German reunification, issues like that that were of far broader significance to the United States. And so it's conceivable that we might have been able to deter Saddam from invading Kuwait if we'd given more aggressive, more forceful warnings to him. I rather doubt it, and I write that in the book. I really think the only thing that would have dissuaded him from invading Kuwait would have been a movement of U.S. forces to the region, something that that our Congress would have objected to at the time and that our Arab allies in the region would really not have welcomed. They frankly thought we were going to overreact to Saddam's threats and provoke him into action. Nevertheless, we didn't deter him, and ironically enough, and I spend a little time on this in the book, ironically enough, had we deterred his invasion of Kuwait, instead of going in there and reversing it in the way that we did, we might today be faced with a far more dangerous situation in the Persian Gulf. We might be faced with an Iraq and a Saddam Hussein with his arms around significant biological and chemical weapons capability and a nuclear weapon. That's not the case. We now have him. He's still there, unfortunately, but he's in a very tight cage.
Well, weren't we increasing Iraq's line of credit after we knew that they were escalating their biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons programs?
No, that's not correct. We did not do that after we had concrete evidence that they were escalating their weapons of mass destruction efforts. We did increase grain credits to Iraq as a part of our policy to moderate their behavior, but we pretty much reevaluated that policy and moved away from it and began to condition all of the things we were doing for Iraq, I think about late March or April of 1990. The invasion of Kuwait, of course, was in August of 1990.
James Baker is my guest, and he's written a memoir about his years as Secretary of State in the Bush administration. The memoir is called The Politics of Diplomacy. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with James Baker, he's written a memoir about his years as Secretary of State, 1989 to 92. It's called The Politics of Diplomacy. When you give a deadline to a dictator on the verge of a war, is that a frightening thing for you? I mean, because then it means if they don't meet the deadline, then you've actually got to start bombing. Yeah.
You've got to go. Well,
I mean, it's kind of, you've got to follow through once you're given a deadline, right?
That's correct. Our view was that the only thing that this man understood was force. He'd built his regime on force. He understands strength. I remember a meeting with Shevardnadze when he said, now, if you set this deadline, we're willing to go along with you, but if you set this deadline, he said, you know, you got to go forward if he doesn't meet it. And I said, we know that full well. And he said, well, have you given consideration to the consequences? Don't believe in all the rosy scenarios that your military will give you. They gave us a lot of rosy scenarios in Afghanistan, and it didn't work. I said, Edward, I want you to listen to a briefing from a general that's traveling with me from our Joint Chiefs of Staff. And we gave the Soviet foreign minister a detailed briefing of what we planned to do and how we were going to do it to kick Iraq out of Kuwait. Iraq, a Soviet client state. This was unprecedented, something we wouldn't even considered having done a year before. But at the end of that briefing, Shevardnadze smiled and he said, I can see you've thought this through.
At what point did you realize that war was going to be inevitable?
Well, I knew after the meeting with Tariq Aziz in Geneva on January the 9th that we were going to war, because the deadline was very real in our view. And it was quite apparent after 7 hours of meeting with him in Geneva that he had no flexibility whatsoever from Saddam. In fact, Saddam sent his brother-in-law to sit right next to him there to make sure he didn't depart from his brief. I knew at that time that we were headed toward war 7 days later. And one of the most emotional moments, frankly, if I might add it here, in my entire service as Secretary of State was when I went from that meeting and addressed some of our fighter pilots and crews at an air base in Taif, Saudi Arabia. The crew, the pilots who would be in the first wave of attacks on Baghdad when the air war was to begin just 7 days later, that was quite an emotional moment.
You threatened Saddam Hussein about what would happen if he used chemical or biological weapons. What did you tell him?
What I told Tariq Aziz in that meeting on January the 9th was that my exact words were, if you use weapons of mass destruction against our forces, the American people will demand vengeance, and we have the means to exact it. I said, this is not a threat. It is a promise. We've just learned now in the last 3 or 4 weeks from UN inspectors that they took that warning to heart. The Iraqis now tell the UN inspectors that's the reason they didn't use that rather significant array of chemical and biological weapons that they had developed.
But in the book, it makes it seem like you were bluffing, because the implication there was that you'd be willing to use tactical nuclear weapons if Iraq used biological or chemical weapons.
I wanted him to think that. As I write in the book, it was a calculated ambiguity. But I can't sit here today and tell you that if Iraq had used biological weapons against our forces, I cannot tell you that the president would not have re-examined his decision not to use tactical nuclear weapons, battlefield nuclear weapons. If we were subjected to attack by biological weapons from an outlaw state like Iraq, I'm not at all sure that the president would not have reconsidered his original decision not to use nuclear weapons.
Where were you the opening night of the war when you were actually watching
I was in my office on
CNN?
Yeah, I was in my office watching on CNN, watching John Holloman and Bernie Shaw reporting from Baghdad, sitting there with some of my staff, and they were saying, well, nothing's happening here. And frankly, it looked to me like we were a few minutes late. And I began to say to my staff, it looks like something may have happened. It should have started by now. And with that, they were reporting from underneath their desks because they said the sky lit up and the bombs began falling.
How did it feel to know that you were, in part, you know, one of the architects of the war you were watching play out on TV?
Yeah, it was a very strange feeling. Something I suppose I'll never experience again in my life. But I felt that we'd done everything we could to eject Iraq peacefully. We'd utilized political, diplomatic, and economic measures. And this was the only thing, in my view, that was going to get the job done. And I think we all felt that we would be able to do it and do it well.
James Baker is my guest. He's written a memoir about his years as Secretary of State in the Bush administration. It's called The Politics of Diplomacy. Well, I have a very important diplomacy question to ask you. How comfortable is the jet that you traveled on when you're doing shuttle diplomacy?
Well, I had a bed on it, and it's the only thing that kept the jet lag from just killing me. But it was a 1959 or 1957 707. Actually, it used to be Air Force One at one time. But it served me well, and I think served the country well. But it was an old airplane, and sometimes in turbulent weather, you'd hear a lot of creaking and groaning. But I never felt safer than when I flew 710,000 miles in 3.5 years, courtesy of the U.S. Air Force. I always felt very, very safe with those Air Force pilots up there.
Got it. You know, in all honesty, I really don't understand how a Secretary of State can deal with all this jet lag and have the kind of presence of mind that you need when you're, you know, doing these high-level negotiations.
People asked me that the other day. I said I took Halcyon. They laughed.
You took Halcyon?
They said, how did you deal with it? I said, well, I took Halcyon and I had a good bed on my airplane. But I did take Halcyon, and I never had any adverse side effects from it or anything. But, it helped me get some rest when the time zones had me all screwed up. But the main way I did it was by taking full advantage of that bed that was on my airplane and sleeping a lot between legs.
Well, James Baker, I want to thank you very much for talking with
us. Thanks, Terry. I really enjoyed talking with you.
James Baker's new memoir about his years as Secretary of State is called The Politics of Diplomacy.